Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and this is a special installment of our live podcast series, because for the first time we have an audience participating on Clubhouse. In this episode, we will speak about a research that has looked into 70 years of press articles in several national newspapers to dig into the question about how are we speaking about Europe. I've been participating in this research together with several other colleagues at Bruegel, Francesco Papadia, Enrico Bergamini, and Emmanuel Mourlant-Roll, who has joined us for the conversation today. Hi, Emmanuel. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And I'm also happy to have some other guests on the mic. Jaume Duch, if I pronounce it correctly, who is the spokesperson of the European Parliament. Jaume, thanks for joining us at The Sound of Economics.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
And Mick Ter Rohost, as well, my pronunciations of foreign languages are always a little bit challenging, who is the founder of one of the few pan-European independent media, which is called Are We Europe? Hi, Mick. How are you as well?
Hi, Giuseppe. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I would also like to thank the audience in the room, looking forward to hear from them as well. After an initial introduction and comments among the guests, we are going to open the floor for the participation of our listeners. So back to our research. The Conference on the Future of Europe is being launched this year by the European Parliament, the Commission, and the European Council. And it sets itself the goal of giving citizens a greater role in shaping EU policies and ambitions. The need to embark into a fully fledged conference to pursue this goal after more than 60 years of European integration resonates with the recurrent narrative, according to which the progressive European unification is an endeavor pursued by elites against the wishes, or at least without the support, of a majority of the population in the European Union. One often mentioned proof of the little support or even interest of citizens towards the European project is the turnout in the European elections, notoriously lower than in national elections, notwithstanding the increase of 8 percentage points in 2019 election. This was still at 50.7%, if I'm not wrong, and Jaume might correct me since he's the expert there. The lack of quantitative indicators to understand the level of Europeanization of the political debate in national conversation has been one of the drivers that led us to consider some imperfect proxies, such as the analysis of national newspapers, to give us additional elements alongside the voters' turnout and alongside existing Eurobarometer surveys about citizens' attachment to the EU. Emmanuel, could you perhaps help explaining to our listeners why we had chosen such an approach together with the other co-authors and summarize for us what we have found out?
Yes, sure. Thanks, Giuseppe. I think you summarized well the original puzzle. So we know that there is a disconnect between the level of integration in Europe, so level of economic integration, of political integration, and the level of interest from European citizens about it. So I guess we can all find from our national member states plenty of qualitative examples. But how can we measure it? So in this project, a couple of working papers and several blogs at Bruegel with Francesco Papadia, Enrico Bergamini, and yourself, Giuseppe, what we did is to explore quantitatively the problem. In doing this, the options could be many. So we decided to focus on three aspects. The first is the voter turnout at European Parliament elections relative to turnout in national elections. And what we see here is that the turnout in EP elections is obviously lower than in national elections, in some cases even much, much lower. But actually, in the recent period, it increased. The second aspect are the Eurobarometer surveys, so the public opinion survey results on interest or attachment to Europe. This attachment, as recorded by Eurobarometer surveys, is fairly stable until the 1990s, and then it grows regularly. What we highlight is that the attachment to the own country for the last 20 years is very high and stable at around 90%, while the attachment to Europe is at a much lower level, but growing in the past 5 years in particular, from about 56% in 2015 to 67% in 2019. So the Eurobarometer surveys are the second aspect. And the third that we looked at are the frequency of European news in three newspapers. So this last one is probably the most challenging methodologically. Intuitively, you can think that newspapers talked more and more about Europe, quite simply because Europe, the European Union, was in charge of more and more aspects of policy across time. But in reality, this is not so obvious because we can't take for granted what newspapers actually reported, and we want to see the detail of how it happened across time. So Enrico and I worked on finding a way to differentiate between what was European, was related to European integration, properly speaking, and what was not European. This is not so easy because obviously, to take a light example, you can think about the Champions League, you can think about football competition. They will mention Europe, but that's obviously not related to European integration. So we need to differentiate between that kind of example, sports-related example, and what is really related to the integration economically and politically of Europe. We picked up three newspapers, La Stampa for Italy, Le Monde for France, and Der Spiegel for Germany. Because we wanted to cover the whole post-war period, and that's really the main one of the most important added values of this paper, from 1945 up through to 2019, we obviously couldn't read each of the articles and put them into the categories we wanted. We're talking here of a total across the three outlets of 13 million newspaper articles. So what we did instead was to build a complex methodology to identify which articles referred to European integration and which did not, without being able to read them. The methodology involved keyword searches and natural language processing methods, the detail of which are in the paper. This allowed us to see the European news as a share of total news. So what are the results? I will just highlight three of them. The first is that we can identify peaks of interest. We can identify most obviously EP elections, European Parliament elections, that are peaked very clearly every 5 years since 1979 and the first direct elections to the European Parliament. Secondly, we can spot some famous landmarks related to European Council meetings that obviously attract a lot of attention. Some G7 meetings, meetings of the seven most industrialized countries, those that had an impact for European integration. Or, for instance, again, the different referendums on EU topics, the referendum of Maastricht in France, in Denmark, the referendum of the European Constitution in the 2000s. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, in terms of general level of interest, we see overall a structural break in the mid-1990s. So if you had the figure in front of your eyes, you'd see lines at a rather similar level for the three newspapers, so Le Monde, La Stampa, and Der Spiegel, throughout the 45-1990 period, with occasional ups and downs explained by my two previous points, so European Parliament elections and some famous landmarks. This level is roughly between 5% and 20% of the total news, depending on the newspaper and depending on the specific moment in time. But from the 1990s, the minimum level is always above 15%, with still occasional ups and downs for the same reasons, EP elections and other landmarks. And that is clearly linked to the Maastricht Treaty and the acceleration of European integration with the creation of the European single currency. So we see a clear change and a clear increase in the reporting of European news. So to conclude, what's the take away from all this? On the one hand, we see an attachment to Europe that is growing across the different indicators. Again, indicators that are not the only one and that have their limits, but we see an increase in the attachment that remains low, that still does not match the level of actual economic and political integration of the EU, but that is growing in particular in the last 20 years and in the last 5 years. And second, on the other hand, we see that the real game changer was the Maastricht Treaty in the 1990s and the move to the euro that clearly completely changed the dimension of integration dynamics in Europe. So that's the main points that I think we can start with for discussing the two papers.
Emmanuel, one maybe additional point or question, because I think it's quite interesting, is also perhaps to point out that some of the few surprises that we've been noticing during the analysis. So, some of the things that we didn't expected to be there. I remember a few moments in times, maybe you can recall those, where the news was big in certain countries, but not in the others, or like a very important moment in landmarks in European history that were actually much less reported in the national news than we might think retrospectively. I think that that could be, even if it's kind of anecdotal to a certain extent, but it's kind of interesting for the discussion we want to have.
Yes, so I can think about two examples. So in a peak that we could have expected in a way, but that we don't really see, you can find the Schuman Declaration, so which really kickstarts the process of European integration, in which is actually Europe Day now. It doesn't really come up in the chart, partly because it's only retrospectively that it became an important moment. So on the moment, on the spot, it was not necessarily as much reported as we could have expected. Another example to show the differences, another example that shows the differences across the different outlets, so the French, the Italian, the German, is another milestone, old milestone of European integration, which is the rejection of the European Defence Community that was meant to simplify to create a European army in 1954. And the plan, the treaty had been agreed and was about to be discussed in the French National Assembly. And the French National Assembly rejected the treaty and the whole negotiation collapsed. And obviously, you see that coming across much more clearly in Le Monde rather than Der Spiegel or La Stampa. So we do see differences across the different outlets. There is another reason that explains the differences that we see, is that obviously Le Monde and La Stampa are dailies, and Der Spiegel, which was the only German source that we could use at least for now, is a weekly.
Thank you, Emmanuel, for this. And on that note, Jaume, you have a very good observatory, being at the European Parliament, on all issues related to the subject matter of European citizens' involvement into the democratic debate. So it will be interesting to hear what you think about our analysis, but also perhaps tell us more. I know we only mentioned it at the beginning, that one of the parameters that we wanted to confront, this evolution of the news cycles with, but it was one of important parameter, was also the voters turned out. So it could be interesting to hear your perspective in general, but also from this kind of cross analysis, that to know if it confirms or not our impressions.
Yes, thank you very much. I hope that you can hear me, because now I didn't hear your last sentence. Is it okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, yes.
Okay, good, perfect. So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to this discussion that I'm sure will be really very interesting. This report introduced by Emmanuel. Of course, I cannot agree more. I mean, if you need to find objective ways to show in the degree of interest of citizens on the European issues or on the European Union as such, probably the three best possibilities are, yes, the turnout, the coverage by media, or how the media are informing on what happens at the European level, and then, of course, the European matter. I will come with some comments on these three ways or three means to understand the level of proximity between the citizens and European policies. The most important one, I think, is the turnout. I mean, of course, we know that the European Parliament is not exactly the copy-paste of a national parliament. We know that the interinstitutional setting in Brussels is much more complicated and, in any case, different from the national ones. So the European elections are not the national elections. You cannot pretend people going to vote in the same numbers, the same percentages for the European elections than for the national elections. And then, of course, you also have to take into account that in each country, the percentage or the traditional percentage of citizens who tend to vote both in the national and in the European elections changes quite a lot. There are countries where for the national elections you can easily get 70, even 80% of people voting. There are countries where even for the national elections, the number of people is less than 50%, sometimes 30-35%. So taking this into account, I think that in any case, when you compare the turnout of the last European elections, 2019, with the previous elections, there is an obvious change of trend, and by the way, a very clear one. 50.6% of people voted. This is roughly 200 million citizens who went to vote between the Thursday and the Sunday of the European elections. This is 8 more points than in 2014. In 2014, we got more or less the same percentage of people than in 2009. So I would say 2014 was the first year where there was no decrease or not real decrease in the number of citizens who went to vote. But then in 2019, there was a reverse trend with these 8 more points. And I think that what it's important also behind this 8 points, that this is not the result of a higher participation in a couple of countries. This is not a German effect or a Spanish effect or a French effect. This is an European effect, because there was an increase in at least 20 among the 28 member states which voted 1 year and a half ago. And then again, this is the first time ever that there is an increase in the number of voters. So all the studies about the fact that this periodical decrease of voters means that there is a democratic deficit, or that the citizens don't care about the European elections, or that the European Union is becoming a fairer objective for the European citizens, I think they can now all be, let's say, classified because of the result in 2019. And then it's also, and I think it's important, is the symbolism behind the fact that 50.6 or 51 percent means a majority of citizens. For the first time since 1984, there was a majority of citizens who voted, and a minority, let's call it like that, okay, it's 49% of people who didn't vote. But it's the first time again since 1984 where a majority or more people vote than people abstain. And 1984, it's quite far. This was the European Union, I mean the European Community of the 12 member states. So comparisons are also difficult from this point of view. And then, of course, the question is why there was this higher turnout and how do you link this to the media?
Yeah, indeed. This was going to be my next question to you, Jaume. What is your analysis from your point of view? Of course, there are several analyses on this about, a kind of crosscut with our own analysis about which are and have been the milestones in the past few years that might have increased the level of attention or the Europeanization of the political debate, because that's let's say the main driver of this, how we can measure this, but also what have been driving this Europeanization.
Look, I think that there are national and European explanations behind this turnout. Of course, the national explanations, we should discuss this country by country, and sometimes it depends on the political moment in the country, how far they were from the national elections. There can be many factors on this. Of course, I would focus now on the EU explanations or the EU reasons, and I can see a couple of them. When you look to the mobilization of people, you see that it was mostly among young people, including even first voters. This could be probably linked to the fact that during the campaign, there was a lot of coverage about climate change and about other topics which are really interesting for young people. Maybe the fact that young people can quite easily understand that some of these topics are going to be solved or not at the European level, but not anymore at the national level. It was probably also linked to the fact that there was quite a campaign during several weeks to mobilize the people, not just the EU campaign or the Parliament's campaign, but the fact that many institutions and many associations and many organizations for the first time in history mobilized themselves to try to convince people to go to vote. But then, yeah, I think that the main factor and the real change there, it's about media. And about media meaning the coverage both in quantity and in quality. In quantity, it's obvious. I mean, you just look to the figures in the EP reports and you will see that the level of reporting on the European elections during the campaign, before the day of the vote for 2019, double in respect to 2014. We were following what we call the core sources. In these core sources, 5 years before, we got around 8,000 reports for the European elections in 2019. It was 16,000 reports. So again, this doubled. But I would say that even more important than the figures is the message, is the narrative which was behind this coverage. And there also there is a substantial difference. And we will then maybe try to explain all together why these differences. Because the storytelling change. In 2009, the storytelling was about the abstention. These are the elections where nobody takes part. These are the elections with the biggest abstention rate in the world. These are the elections that don't matter and only a few bunch of people are going to vote. Of course, if what the citizens are reading or listening during the previous months or weeks before the elections day is that nobody is going to vote, what happens is that most of them, of course, will stay at home. In 2014, this changed. I think that it was less about abstention. There was a little bit more of politics. There was, for the first time, this Spitzenkandidaten element, which helped a little bit in some countries, in Germany, for example, in Austria, in Luxembourg. But then the real difference is 2019. And in 2019, you can see that the main narrative is about the importance of the elections. This is the first time where the journalists say to the citizens, attention, look, these are important elections.
Thank you, Jaume, for this overview, which is extremely interesting and gives a very good perspective. And also, it gives me the opportunity to, I mean, because you mentioned the storytelling and you mentioned the framing, this is a very, very important element when it comes to what it makes a news, even if it's, you know, a reporting from Brussels, you know, about a specific news that is happening here. This reporting, what makes it European reporting, or what it makes it a national reporting, like a national news happening here in Brussels? That is one of you know, the very questions. And I virtually look at Mick because I cannot look at him since we are only connected by voice. But I turn to Mick because. One of the big themes or the elephants in the room of our research, but also in general of our conversations that we have also in several media of people that are interested in European policy and European communication, is the way media contributes to the public opinion. But especially the lack of a European media landscape. You know, in the end of the day, one of our measurement was also to look into the differences of how Europe is talked about at national level, in order to highlight the fact that even if some issues are common, like for example when there was the Euro crisis. For instance, there was a lot of reporting about the Euro crisis, but the way the reporting was made at national level was completely different and was a very national or even nationalistic. So at Are We Europe, you are also advocating for the need for a pan-European public sphere. And I would be curious to know what you think about our findings.
Well, okay. First of all, I think that yes, there is in some way this sphere. Sorry,
Jaume, Giuseppe. This was for Mick.
Sorry. Excuse me.
No problem.
No worries, Jaume. You can go ahead as well.
I'm totally happy to.
But thank you for inviting Giuseppe, and thank you for sharing those interesting thoughts, Emmanuel and Jaume. Yes, it is. I think one of the most difficult questions, I think, for generations now. Why is there no truly European media? I know, friends, I look at the audience, I see Gianpaolo, also from Fox Europe, who also one of the big questions he's asking with their organization. I see Natalie Nugaret of like former mainstream media, formerly at a big media like Le Monde and The Guardian. Like there are so many interesting initiatives popping up around Europe and the European public space, the media space, as you would call it. And that's also why I founded Are We Europe. I found this a glaring gap that there was between the coverage in national media or big players and the local media. There was just nothing in between regional, but also nothing above the national media that truly looked at the European developments. Obviously, there have been projects like The European magazine that was in the 80s and 90s. I'm sure some of you might know it. It's just incredible to see how difficult it is to set up something truly European. There's a lot of obstacles, as we all know, language, the market, defining the audience, reaching out over borders, but also defining topics that cross borders. And especially that last thing, crossing borders, is what we decided to do with Are We Europe. So we were born from this from seeing the national media always talking about Europe as an afterthought. And if they talked about Europe, it was always negative in the last 10 years. It was always crisis, from Euro crisis to migration crisis to whatever bureaucratic crisis was happening in Brussels. And it is a bit of an elephant in the room, indeed. Giuseppe said it very well. Also, we saw that in the recent Dutch elections, there was actually a Twitter hashtag that was EU elephants in political and national media cycles. It's just always an afterthought, Europe. And at Are We Europe, we decided to change that around. We are basically a media collective of over 750 freelance journalists, storytellers, designers, developers, journalists, of course, video makers, podcast makers from all over the continent. And we basically ask ourselves one question: what does it mean to be European? Are we a part of it? Yes or no? Like, who is the we? Where does it stop? Where does it end? And we're a critical reflection of European identity, and we try to do so through multimedia stories and border breaking stories, as we call it, and showing that borders are just another construct that we put into place. We can just discuss Europe as if it's a borderless place, even though we know there's many obstacles out there. And there's many great initiatives from Vox Europe, Forum.eu, Euractiv, Politico Brussels, of course, or Politico Europe, even though it's an American company. So we're definitely not alone in this, but it's really amazing to see this study coming out. So thank you all for contributing to that. And we were following it very closely. The European public space is a difficult thing to talk about, but it's very, very necessary that more and more pan-European media collaborations, projects, and even media like ourselves are popping up all over.
If you would have to point out one thing, because you are part of this endeavor, if there was one thing that you would say projects like yours or other pan-European media, could be like TV, could be, you know, of course there is a Euronews and so on, but for some projects like that to really become mainstream, you know, to really become the household names, what would we need? You know, what do you think would be the kind of process that or resources, or I don't know, policies, regulations? What is the main thing that is lacking at the moment for such a pan-European public media space?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's mostly scale, and that is where the difficulty of, I mean, Europe as a market is really big, but Europe is basically a patchwork of different markets, spreading out over languages, regions, thematic things, and like it's just not enough to talk about the EU. We need a European media that is broadcast on every television set across Europe. Arte is, of course, doing a little bit of that, and there is more and more coming up, but there it needs to be in every television set and every radio station. There needs to be that one European national or European broadcaster. That's the scale you need to truly get that, but I don't think that is what is easy to set up at this moment, and maybe also not what is necessary, because another public broadcaster is also difficult to streamline that with the customer needs and also the falling trust in let's say mainstream or big media organizations. So I really see cross-border collaborations between this this range of smaller media as the way forward. And then, you know, like hard-hitting investigative journalism things, like for instance the Panama Papers or things like that, I think that could really show that, hey, our problems don't end at our borders. We need these collaborations across borders, and that I think will be, you know, that can feed back into the media that regular media news consumers, but also young people, of course, on different platforms are consuming. And I think it's not a you shouldn't come up with one new project that encompasses everything, but it should be this one sort of like feeling of what a European story or what a European journalism is that should seep into this amazing wide range of smaller initiatives that are out there. So it should be more defining European journalism and letting that seep through on all levels of news consumption and media, I would say.
Thank you, Mick. I would like now to open the floor for remarks, questions, reflections, additional comments from the audience. So, you know the drill, you need to raise the hand and I will allow you on stage for the mic. Don't be shy. Hi, Laurent. I have a few.
Hi, Giuseppe. Thanks please, for letting me in. And
yeah, as usual, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, please just introduce yourself and then go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Giuseppe, for the conversation and for letting me in. I am a member of a network of influence or a think tank called Respublica Europa, which was set up in the run-up for the European elections over 2 years ago now, which pushed for an ambitious renewal of Europe. So and very concerned also by you know what the political landscape looked like prior to the European election. We just discussed that earlier, so very interesting to hear what you're saying today. There is one question that I think that you raised, Giuseppe, and I would be interested to hear both Mick and Jaime's view on the on this question is on the on the role of well regulations, but also on whether you see as a as you know a positive element to have European funding or public money or public regulations or set up in place to support the creation of pan-European media, or you know whether this is a curse more than a blessing to have this framework financial support to media, which in itself you know may pride itself from being independent and being autonomous. Any thoughts you'd have on this, on whether this is something to support, or in the contrary, whether this is maybe more creating more problem than anything else and affecting even the credibility of the media in the first place? I would be very interested to have your views. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Laurent. I would take a few questions and remarks first, and then we are going for a round with the speakers for feedback. So I have François on my list. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you very much, Giuseppe. My name is François, and I work for FEPS, the Foundation for European Progressive Studies, the Social Democrat Foundation. My reflection is mainly about what we're living right now, the pandemic, and how much it's contributing to bringing Europe in our media landscape, because of the coverage, because trying to explain what the Commission is doing with the vaccine program. So I think in comparison to a crisis moment, like the Euro crisis, the migration one, there is a lot of work done by journalists to explain the processes of how the European Union functions. I doubt that we got so much extensive reflection about how Frontex works, how Dublin mechanism works, or even the ECB work. So do you see that having an impact also on the development of a European public sphere? Thank you.
Thank you for your reflections. I keep the round. Nathalie, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you very well.
Hi, Giuseppe. Thanks for having me, and thanks for all the interesting comments. I've got several friends in this group. It's nice. I just to add perhaps to what some of the great comments that Mick made. I think that, you know, to create something that would tick that box of a genuinely cross-European, pan-European media space, I think this will require many more resources than are currently available, and that requires probably, you know, a form of campaigning on that. And I see civil society and citizens across Europe as more of a resource for that than actually top-down government decisions. This may sound like, you know, utopic, but I would see something, a strategy with many, many more resources put towards the notion of embracing the continent as a space for journalistic coverage, crossing, you know, different outlooks and perspectives, and very, very close to how people actually experience in their lives realities that have to do with belonging to this continent. So a strategy to lift all boats. So I'm in favor of something that would actually address, you know, helping every single initiative out there that tries to break out of bubbles and break out of borders or national silos. Another thought is, you know, I think most of us on this call, and we're speaking English right now, I think we'll agree, but I'm, this is actually a question to everybody who's on this call. I think we'll agree that most of the descriptions, information that we get from media organizations that set as their goal to cover a large swath of territory, not just a nation state, and not just focusing on domestic politics or domestic national realities. Most of the other organizations that do embrace and have the potential to cover the continent are UK or US based. And I've worked most of my career in French media, and for the last 6 years I've been with a UK-based beautiful media, The Guardian. But I've maybe, like me, you will agree that that's not enough anymore, right? For us to really get that visibility on what's happening across our human realities across the continent, not just the Brussels institutions, which are very important, but we don't really get a sense of, you know, what others are experiencing across the continent. And I think in the COVID context, that's been highly visible or highly relevant, that we need that wider lens, that wider focus. And so one question I had for you is, you know, if anybody has, some wishes to express on how they would like to see European realities, and again, on the ground, human realities better covered. And the second question is, we all want the diversity of this continent to be preserved and amplified and embraced and tolerated. And linguistic diversity is part of that, certainly. But look at the reality. We're speaking English altogether. And I wondered, would you agree that English is the lingua franca, and that English would be the starting point for something that would help weave together journalists, media initiatives that have that European spirit? I'll stop there.
Thank you, Natalie. That was a really, really good insight. I have quite a lot of ideas coming from what you're saying, but I would like to hear first from the others who joined from the audience, and then we are going to go for a last round among us, reflecting and perhaps replying to some of your inputs. Benedetta, hi. Benedetta, are you there?
Yes, sorry, I had a problem with the mic. Good morning. I have a question, especially for Jaume, but not exclusively, on the conference on the future of Europe, as I am following this dossier for the European Committee of the Regions. My question is, are you monitoring somehow how the media are presenting the conference and the first perception? What is the first perception of the citizens about this initiative? What is your impression about that? I think that this kickoff moment of the conference is very important to build the right perception in the citizens. So I would like to know if you already have some information on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Benedetta. And Angela.
Thank you. I'm a lecturer in the University of Glasgow and a historian of European integration processes. I had a comment / question, which ties together the elections and the, way we vote for the European Parliament, and this question of the pan-European space for the press and communication about Europe. And my impression is that we continue to think nationally because the means are national. So when we vote for the European Parliament, we do vote for national political parties, the usual ones, which then will decide more or less after the election where to position themselves in the European Parliament groupings. And I think a sense of being European and voting for European things would only be prompted when we get to vote for European political parties. But the difficulty I see there is the same that we're discussing for the press. So would it be possible to think and conceive and promote the creation of federations in which you do have genuinely European political parties and genuinely European press, media, which then have their own antennas or their own branches at national level. That would allow to think at the European level while at the same time communicated in the local languages, so preserving that diversity, which is important and is a resource. Language would also be paramount to reach the vast majority of the citizens who do not necessarily have fluency in English, and you know, make them feel that they are not losing out because they are being spoken at or with in a foreign language. And for the press and these sort of political parties, it will be possible to agree on the content which would be at the European level and concerning European affairs, and then ripple that into national audiences. And the last part of my comment is about the press that could be done. I'm not a specialist at all, but I can see the problem you're pointing at in terms of resources. Could it be possible to think in terms of consortia, or you know, like the FEPS that was just mentioned, in terms of federation? So there are some media, some newspapers already generally thinking, you know, in European terms and generally interested in doing that even better. Could they gather together in a permanent structure, which is a consortium, and then add that branch to their activity rather than creating new big sort of media corporations? Thanks.
Thank you so much, Angela. And I have Chloe and Gianpaolo. I would like kind of ask you to speed it up a bit because we are kind of going run out of time, and we would like to have also a bit of a reaction from the speakers before closing.
Yeah, absolutely, Giuseppe. Hi, everyone. My name is Chloe. I am an environmental justice activist, and I recently launched a podcast, which is called The Burning Case, and the idea is to bring EU politics mainly to the general public and especially to young people. And I mean, I think it's super interesting, everything that has been said on that panel and by people from the audience, but I think the complete shift in storytelling hasn't necessarily been really addressed. And we've been talking about the EU for years and years and years, and that is mainly due to the fact that national governments are very, very happy with using the EU as a scapegoat a lot of the time for what's wrong at the national level. So for a very long time, the people in Europe, the citizens, have been considering the EU as, you know, sometimes a source of problems or a source of over bureaucracy, which, let's be honest, is often very true. So I think until we address this, well, first of all, this complexity, but also this need for a complete and radical change of narrative, then we won't get the people interested. And we can see it with the way the Conference on the Future of Europe is communicated. You know, it's outside of the EU bubble. I don't know anyone who has heard about the Conference of the Future of Europe. It's still very much something that is happening in Brussels. And until the MEP do that work of going in back to the national country to talk about it, but also until there's this change of narrative that presents Europe as a source of opportunities rather than a source of problems, but also as a diverse, inclusive place where people actually recognize themselves instead of being very, very close and very much not diverse and not inclusive, then all these ideas about creating pan-European media, about spreading the message, I mean, I see it very much hitting a wall. And what we are seeing right now with the podcast, for instance, is that there is a real interest about knowing more about the EU institution and what's happening, the behind the scenes, the political work. But there's also, as Nathalie was saying, a real interest in addressing Europe and understanding Europe from a grassroots level and the experiences that Europeans have. So this change of narrative, for me, it's very much the source of it all. So I was wondering what the panel were thinking about that.
Thank you, Chloe. Yeah, you're completely right on this, but I mean, I'm for sure I want to hear back about the Conference on the Future of Europe, because there was more questions on this. Gianpaolo, and then unfortunately I have to close the mic, because we are going to run out of time, so we still want to have a little bit of time for comments. So Gianpaolo, please.
Thank you. So I'm Gianpaolo Cardo, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Vox Europe, a pan-European media in several languages. So from my experience, what I see is that there is very little interest from national legacy media in getting pan-European or reaching a pan-European audience, basically because they know very well their own audience, their own national audience, and there is very little interest in getting to reach other audiences, simply because they cannot monetize them, or it's very hard to monetize them. And then there is also the reason, the question of translation. If you want to reach an audience which is not in your own language, you have to translate, and translation is very expensive. Really, it's really a major cost. Actually, currently the only real pan-European media are English-speaking, of course, because English is the lingua franca of Europe. But their interest in pan-European news, or getting a pan-European angle for news, is very little. I mean, both the Financial Times, the Economist, or the Guardian are read all over Europe, and they sometimes deal with European news and issues very well. But they are really targeting their own audience. Their own domestic audience, I would say, rather than audiences localized in other European countries. And also localization is a major issue for pan-European news, because the way news are consumed in France are different from the way they are consumed in Greece, for example, and you have to adapt news to those public, and adaptation also comes with a cost. So as a conclusion, I would say that getting pan-European is something worth doing. Legacy media won't do it because it's too expensive, and this is why there are many small grassroots, I would say, initiatives like the ones that were mentioned, AWI Europe, Politico, Vox Europe, or Café Babel, and so on, which are very much committed and in many languages, and that have a true pan-European angle, but they are rather niche than the large legacy media.
Thank you, Gianpaolo, and your reflection somehow goes hand in hand with what Natalie and Mick have been discussing about somehow. I guess this is not by chance, giving the background that the three of you have. I would like to give the chance to react to the many and interesting inputs that you all have been giving to our room and our podcast live. Thank you so much for making it lively, and also to bring fresh and different perspectives. Just from my side, I have just a couple of things I think that were said, and I wanted to reiterate. The first thing, with Mick, but not Natalie as well, and to a certain extent also the others have said, is the fact about making the news interesting for the people. Making a European news interesting means probably thinking about the storytelling, but thinking about going beyond the politics and economics as well. So building up the cultural side, but also what makes a story European, you know, like something that is happening in a small village in the south of Italy maybe might be seen as a very local news, but actually could be relevant and could be transformed into a European news. And I think this kind of turnaround about how and what is European, and someone mentioned, I mean, I think Francois mentioned the pandemic and the way some local news are becoming all of a sudden speaking to everyone. So I think that this kind of new way of looking at different levels and the different storytellings regarding the news is extremely important. So that's one element. The second element about the media and the language, definitely a big challenge, as we know. I think that there is an interesting and perhaps a bit under the radar experiment that is under our eyes, And it's happening, and I'm noticing it more and more on one media, which is, of course, it's privately owned and it's American. But I speak about Netflix. I mean, one simple piece of legislation from the EU that basically requires that structures like Netflix needs to have a certain percentage of the production in Europe. It's been allowing to have a lot of products which are European and are, you know, crossing the language borders with subtitles. Now, I know that not every media can have the same level, but I think that this kind of experiment that is happening on Netflix could be at least as an inspiration for a media landscape that is going to be more and more multimedia, more multi-layered, but also, going to the question about how is this only a matter of funding or not, there is also like some regulation sometimes, and in that case the regulation on media has been helping at the European level for the issue of Netflix. But I will stop here. That were my let's say replies and comments on what was said. I would like to hear from Emmanuel, Jaume and Mick both replying to what they heard in the room so far, but also trying to give their kind of last remarks so that we can go slowly towards the end of this episode. Who would like to start?
I can jump in if you want to, Giuseppe. Well, thank you everybody for the very interesting remarks. I think one of the last points that was raised by Chloe about the storytelling is absolutely central. The question of how the debate is framed. In a way, it's unavoidable because we talk more often than not about crisis. So it's in a way a very classic story of talking about the trains that are delayed or late, not the trains that arrive in time. So what I think is key, however, in the framing is that we need to build a better understanding of what the EU does and what are its advantages and limits, rather than just waking up suddenly when there is a crisis. Oh, by the way, what is the EU about? So that is the key, I think, to me in the storytelling. And apart from that, I think my takeaway is that I see two different strategies in this story of the European media. One is to encourage pan-European media, and that we talked about quite a lot. And the other is also to enhance, to improve the coverage of European affairs in national media. And I think the two strategies actually go hand in hand because they follow complementary logics and address different European challenges in the way what Giuseppe was just mentioning, the very local stories that actually have wider implications. So English may be the European lingua franca, but we do not all speak English. European affairs matter, but we may not all be interested in them. What matters, again, is to explain why European affairs matter. So when Mick was very nicely saying that Europe was a patchwork of different markets, I think we just need a patchwork of strategies to address this, both improving European medias, but also improving the coverage of European affairs in national media, because many people won't necessarily be interested in pan-European media.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Jaume, would you like to go next?
Yes, of course. I'll try to be very brief, but I think that we could discuss at least 2 more hours on this. From my side, first of all, yes, of course, we have to try to help to create all this pan-European media when possible. But I don't think that this is the solution. If what you want is to create a closer link between the citizens and the European Union, because at some point there is a little bit of artificiality in this solution, and also because you will probably create a kind of niche, I would even say, an elitist niche because of the language. I tend to agree with Emmanuel and with Chloé, maybe, that this is more about how the national media reports on European affairs. And maybe the first thing, and this is also linked to the framing, is that you don't need to announce that you are going to talk about Europe each time that you talk about Europe or you inform about Europe. Europe is part of the national politics, and the best you link the national and European levels of politics, the best it will be reported, and the best it will be interesting for the citizens. You have also to avoid, I mean, this distinction. Now this is national, now this is European. I mean, when you talk about migration or you talk about women's rights, why are you going to do this or to try to place this difference every time? I agree also with this idea about the human realities. Yes, I think that we could try, and this is, I think, what the Parliament is also doing, even with its own grant scheme, is to promote European stories, human stories in the national media, and in the media which are really consumed by most of the citizens. And national media, sometimes it's the local in the regional media. It's not the big newspapers or online media in the capitals. It's also about how do you report, and this has been said. Of course, because of the fact that most of the information comes from the correspondents in Brussels and that they have to choose among 10, 15, 20 daily news, at the end of the day, the reporting is the reporting about the crisis. It's the reporting about what doesn't work and not about all the things that are decided in a positive way in Brussels, which means that this European information cannot be only in the hands of people in Brussels, must be in the hands of the news desks in the countries. And I think that this is also a line where the institutions can do a lot. Very, very briefly, of course, this European vaccination strategy now is putting the whole European Union and institutions in the front line and in the headlines. Some days it's more positive, some days it's less positive, but there are still, we also need quite a more interesting framing. I mean, we all now, and we all listen to Joe Biden saying several times that his target, his purpose was to vaccinate 1 million Americans per day. Okay, the European Union is now vaccinating 2 million citizens per day, and in 2 weeks it will be 3 million citizens per day. These are, in my opinion, the messages that are still lacking. And on the conference, of course, Benedetta, right now there is a small coverage. It's very bubble, very Brussels. It, by the way, it's quite, I would say, skeptic about what this conference is going to produce. But I'm not, I would say, I'm not surprised, because the conference didn't start yet until now. It has been just about a lot of discussions, very internal, very interinstitutional. So you cannot expect citizens being interested about something that didn't start. The platform is going to be launched on Monday, so I would assess the success in media terms or in media coverage of this conference starting from next Monday. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jaume. And last but not least, Mick.
Yes. Wow. A lot to talk about, of course, a lot to reflect on. I'm going to keep it quite brief. I heard some things about, I really liked your last point, Jaume. Like, it shouldn't be announced that you're talking about Europe. And that's also what we are trying to do. We're trying to erase those borders, not by ignoring them or saying they don't exist, because there are borders, both physical borders, as in geographical borders, and obstacles or borders between social class, between regions, between language, between education, between all these things. So we're not ignoring them, but we're going to try to focus on the things that overlap and cross these borders. Again, both physical and metaphysical. I really agree with what you're saying there, Jaume. I heard one point, I think it was the first question from Laurent about EU funding. And it is, I think, would definitely be a blessing in disguise. I think for two reasons. One, it will always be equated with the EU, and you will not in any form steer back Eurosceptics by having an EU-funded public broadcasting system, even though I think they have money and they should invest it, but they should give it to local, non-EU, slightly tinging propagandaist media initiatives. And two, I really think we should take away talking about the EU from the media. It's, again, I think it should be about culture, it should be about stories, it should be about fun stuff, it should be about entertainment, it should be on TikTok, it should be on Instagram, it should be podcast, YouTube. That is where you're going to get the next generation of people who are like at best ambivalent about Europe. And we should try to show them that there's a really vibrant community of people all across the continent. And that's what the journalism should be about. And then obviously as well, hard-hitting investigative journalism about all the problems that the continent is facing. But we should really try to not be linked to the EU too much as a pan-European media, even though it will be difficult because hopefully they're going to inject some money into it. So I think that's a difficult nut to crack. Mostly, I think it should be about collaboration between all these initiatives because there's so much good stuff going out out there, and we need to raise all boats or lift all boats, as Natalie also said. That was really a good expression. Thank you, Giuseppe, and everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mick, Jaume, Emmanuel, but everyone else as well that have been following, participating, and listening to this live episode of The Sound of Economics from Clubhouse. I would like to remind you that you can read our series of blogs and papers regarding our research around Europe in national press on our website www.bruegel.org, alongside the full library of the open access analysis and studies by all our scholars. So until next time, bye bye.